History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold as long as people like you and me are willing to take just a couple of simple steps. First, take the initiative and ask a few questions, and then listen patiently as some of those memories, often buried for decades, start to filter their way out. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This is the first weekend in February, which by now you know is Black History Month. And if you're someone who listens to this program on a regular basis, I don't have to sell you on the value of history. Quite frequently, the stories and perspectives our veterans share on Hometown Heroes are things none of us could have ever really learned in school. The heart behind Black History Month runs through a similar vein, with an aim to open all of our eyes to achievements and experiences that we just haven't been made aware of. And there's always a story behind the story. For instance, you know Jackie Robinson was the first African-American to play in the major leagues when he broke in with the Brooklyn Dodgers. You might know Larry Doby was the first to play in the American League. But did you know that they were both among the approximately 1 million African-Americans to serve in our armed forces during World War II? A still segregated military at that. On this program, we've learned there was another future Baseball Hall of Famer who was actually offered the chance to break the color barrier first, Monty Irvin, but declined that opportunity because of how he had been affected by serving in the war. The National Football League was integrated 1 year before baseball. Jackie Robinson's former UCLA football teammates, Kenny Washington and Woody Strode, along with former Nevada Wolfpack star Marion Motley and Ohio State alum Bill Willis, broke that barrier. For Strode and Motley, that came only after their own service in World War II. It might be hard to believe that it wasn't until 1950 that black players suited up in the NBA. There were three that season, and while Earl Lloyd was too young to have served in World War II, Chuck Cooper spent the final year of the war in the Navy, and Nathaniel Sweetwater Clifton, all 6'8" of them, spent 3 years in the Army serving in the European theater. And here's a question for you to ponder when you think of the integration of those major professional sports leagues, not to mention the ultimate integration of the U.S. military under President Harry Truman in 1948. How much longer would it have taken for those groundbreaking developments to materialize without the powerful example of those 1 million African-American men and women during World War II? Not only did they help save the world with what they contributed overseas, victory for America abroad, but they really did contribute immeasurably to the other half of what you've heard called the double V, victory over prejudice and discrimination back home in the United States. Today we're going to hear the memories of two men who both went on to distinguished careers in the medical field. Dr. Fitzalbert Marius would become a trailblazing heart surgeon, while Robert Hammond would work in the preventative realm of public health and become director of environmental health for Los Angeles County. We're going to start with Hammond's story. Born to a black father and a white mother in 1926, he grew up in Philadelphia.
Right after Pearl Harbor, I became a air warden. Used to ride my bicycle around. Anyone that had lights on, we would tell them to put it out. We were kind of afraid of Hitler at the time because they used to send the Graf Zeppelin over, and it had those swastikas on it as youngsters. It would land in Lake Hood, New Jersey, and they had all these ropes and things hanging down, and somebody told us, you better run and hide because those ropes are going to come down and bring you up to that Zeppelin. They're going to carry you away. So when that thing came, we would run and hide. I was much younger then when that Zeppelin came. But I'll never forget that because that was part of what was going on in the world at the time with Adolf Hitler. He was really on the rampage at the time and doing things that was unheard of, killing a lot of people. That's how we got the stories from. We got it from the radio, and Walter Winchell, Edward R. Murrow, yeah, him especially. They would come over and talk about Hitler's conquest in Europe and things like that. And in school, I was in junior high school, I think, at the time. And they talked about the fifth column. Like, we'd go to Philadelphia at certain times, and down Market Street, the brown shirts would march and carry the Nazi banner. I remember that. And we used to throw tomatoes at them and just hated it. And that swastika and the brown shirts, the flags and all that was the German-American Bund over here at the time. I didn't know what that was. I thought it was just, you know, I thought maybe it was Hitler trying to get us. But that was all part of my growing up at the time. When I became 17, my brothers, my oldest brother, he went to West Point and became a Buffalo Soldier. Matter of fact, my great-grandfather was the bandmaster for the original Buffalo Soldiers, and my oldest brother was the last of the Buffalo Soldiers because they disbanded that. They used to go on parade and things like that from West Point, and they disbanded that and put those men into Patton's Army. And so he went in the Army. My cousins went into the Army. My dad was gone. He had passed away years earlier. And it was just seeing uniforms. And all the guys wanted to wear a uniform. And at the time, I wanted one. After being an air raid warden and getting involved, became 17, I found out if I could go into the service at age 17, but the one that I could go into was the United States Navy. So I went down and joined the Navy and brought the papers back to get my mother to sign it. And she wouldn't sign it. And I said, well, if you don't sign it, I'll sign it for you. So she said, you really want to go? I said, yeah, nothing's going to happen to me. I'll be all right. So she signed it, and I went into the Navy.
Looking at these pictures on your wall, you look every bit of that tender age of 17 with that Navy hat on after you enlisted. What was that like, being welcomed to the Navy, and did you have any idea what you were in for?
No, I did not know what I was in for. Most of my friends were Italian people, Jewish people, and Polish people. And we went to school together in Camden. And a lot of these guys, they joined the Navy too. So we got on the train and we're going to Great Lakes. And what they did, the train went south. And as it got into Washington, D.C., they put it on the side, the train. And a conductor came through, and persons of color, you got to move to another car. So I said, I'm not moving any place. I'm staying right here. You can't make me move. So my Italian friends and everybody crowded around me, and they said, no, if he moves, we move. So they said, well, we'll get the police in here and lock all of you up. I said, well, we don't care. We're going to war anyway. And I said, yeah, I might as well die here than die overseas. I said, matter of fact, what's going on? And then they came in and said, well, you're down south now, and you cross the Mason-Dixon line, and we don't mix. At that time, they call us colored. Yeah. They don't mix colored and white together anywhere in the south. And that was brand new to me. And it was also new to my friends. Well, we grew up together, went to school together and things like that, played ball. And they weren't going to take any stuff about all that segregation and Jim Crowism that they had in the South. So we stayed in that car. They just locked the doors on us. Wouldn't let anybody in there. So the car went through D.C., went through Virginia, and got over into, I think it was Ohio. And that's when they didn't say anything. They came through and said, oh, you guys can go wherever you want. They unlocked the doors.
It sounds like, at least for a while, that was a pretty rude awakening for you. And I guess the question is, was that a sign of similar things to come for you?
Yes, it was. Pure hell. I'll put it that way. I mean, I had to endure a lot at that time. On the way to Great Lakes, when we got there, this is in the winter, around December 14th or 15th is when I got in the Great Lakes. I had on an overcoat, two pairs of pants, a wool sweater. And when I got there, we had to stand in line outside in the cold for about 2 hours to get into camp. A man in front of me, he was just freezing. He came from the deep south, and he was cold. So I took off a pair of pants and gave it to him and gave him my sweater so he could stay warm. Later on, we got in the chow hall. They fed us chicken soup and bologna sandwiches, and they gave us prune juice. Never forget that. And then they marched us over to a place where it was late at night, and we went to bed. And the next morning was pure hell that we had to go through at that camp, because this is when they sent all the white guys to one camp and all the colored guys or black guys to another camp. And I didn't understand that. I said, this is the United States Navy, and they separating us? Why? And I asked the officer, why are you doing that? He said, just shut the... Mm-hmm. Yep, yeah, yep. And I didn't say any more. And they sent me to a place called Camp Lawrence. It was a segregated camp at Great Lakes. And I went through 6 weeks of boot training over there. We marched and everything and went through the rigors of what we had to do in the Navy at the time. Now, the strange thing that happened was my mother's brother was a captain in the Navy, and he was the personnel officer. He found out I was there, sent for me. I wouldn't give him away, though. I just said, Uncle Charlie, don't worry about it.
And am I inferring correctly that he was Caucasian?
Yes, he was. See, there's my mother's picture over there. And my sister, yes.
So no one's putting it together that you two are related. He is your Caucasian uncle, that you're the only one who knows he's your uncle.
Yes. Uh-huh. So I didn't say anything. And what he did, he put me in the Great Lakes Choir. I enjoyed that because I got liberty every weekend. We had to go into Chicago and practice and sing. We got on the radio and we'd sing all sorts of songs. Every Sunday we would sing with the Great Lakes Choir. And I did that until even through course. Captain Hayes sent, at the time, he said, Robert, I'm going to send you to course school. He said, matter of fact, we need about 20-some of you guys from Camp Lawrence to go to course school. So they gave us a test. 22 of us passed it, and we went to Navy course school and went 9 weeks of training at Great Lakes. And from there, they sent us to the Brooklyn Naval Hospital. They sent 10 of us there. The other guys went to St. Albans, to a hospital there for further training. Then things begin to happen right after that. I got used to the difference at Great Lakes. It wasn't that bad because we ate, we slept, we were clean, we had clean clothes. We could go into Chicago. Went out on liberty whenever we could, and we had a lot of fun. I mean, being 17 going on 18, what do? You you go look for girls, and you drink some booze, and then you just go dancing at the time. Duke Ellington and Lionel Hampton was playing Take the A-Train and Flying Home at the time. And that was the music. We didn't listen to Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller. We didn't like that kind of music. You couldn't dance to it right. We'd go into the State Theater and the Regal Theater in Chicago, and that's where I first learned about Ella Fitzgerald. She was singing there with a man named Chick Webb, a drummer. And we had a lot of fun in Chicago. But that broke up the monotony with the kinds of things we went through at Great Lakes. But anyway, from there, over at the Brooklyn Naval Hospital, that's another experience, a very traumatic experience. Segregation had backfired on the armed forces at the time. In 1942, Roosevelt put black Marines there. So they sent those men to Munford Point. Right. And the medical care, most of these guys are from the South, and they didn't get good medical care. And when they got to Mumford Point, they were sick. Most of them were sick. They had worms. They had a whole bunch of other things wrong with them. The white corpsmen would not treat them. For anything they had, they gave them a Brown's mixture and cod liver oil. They had a broken arm. That's what they gave them. So they had to get some black corpsmen there. So seven of us, when we finished training at the hospital, were sent to Mumford Point. But my first experiences at the Brooklyn Naval Hospital, it was very traumatic because what they did with us, they put us to work in the kitchen. The first day we got there, we were assigned to kitchen duties, washing dishes and serving food. And we had the Red Crosses on our uniforms and all that. And an officer came down there, a commander, came down. He saw this. He says, "Are you guys corpsmen?" We said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You're not stewards, mates. What are you doing working in the kitchen? You belong up on the wards." So he went and got the chief petty officer in charge of us. "What are these men doing in the kitchen?" He said, "Sir, we can't send them up on the wards. They would interact with the white nurses up there." And that commander told that chief, he said, "Look, you get those men up on the wards now." He said, "If you don't do it, I'm going to bust you down." He said, "The lowest rank that one of those men have is a hospital apprentice, second class. I'm going to bust you down to that." So we went up on the wards. And when we went up on the wards, it was new training up there. Was up there 2 weeks. The first black Navy nurse came there. She was a full lieutenant, and she outranked most of the white nurses. And guess where they put her to work? In the linen room. So I went to work with Mrs. Daly. And we'd go out on liberty sometimes together. And she said, "You're not supposed to fraternize with officers, you know." I said, "Well, I'm not fraternizing with you. I'm just going out to New York with you." But because I had relatives in New York that I visited, and I had a good time in New York, going over to the Savoy and all that, listening to good music. Turned 18, I go into the bars. I could get a drink. They'd serve us because we were in uniform. Sure. I didn't say anything. But anyway, the experiences at that hospital, the way the seven of us that were there, see, there were only about 21, 22. Seven of us went to the hospital for surgical duties and field training for injuries that people would get in the field. And that's what I learned. Seven other guys went to the ships. I wanted to go to the ships. I wanted to go aboard the USS Mason or the US Pelican that were all black Navy ships. I wanted to go on board one of those. But they wouldn't send me because they said I'm not old enough. They wanted guys in their 20s over there. So they sent me to the Marines. And that's when I left the Naval Hospital and went down to Mumford Point. That's where a whole lot of mess started.
Well, and to wrap up that discussion about Brooklyn Naval Hospital and the prejudice that you really experienced there, I'm just curious if what the effect of that was on you. Did it, because you can laugh about it now in retrospect, I don't think you're laughing too much then. Did it anger you? Did it motivate you to prove yourself every bit as patriotic and loyal as white soldiers were? What do you think the effect was on you?
Well, being in New York and having a lot of relatives there and also in Philadelphia, I was told to persevere through that. At the time, you had a man named Walter White, who was the head of the NAACP. You had A. Philip Randolph, very prominent black man at the time. And they formed an organization called the Double V for servicemen. And this was the sign, the Double V. And that is, we had a fight overseas and we had a fight at home. One was for prejudice here, discrimination and prejudice, and the other one was against the enemies of the United States. And we had to fight those two.
And the results of that fight would change generations to come. It's time for our first break, but we're going to hear more of Robert Hammond's story in a moment. Celebrating Black History Month on Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, starting the month of February with a focus on Black History Month. With the Olympics underway in Beijing, World War II veteran Robert Hammond would remind you that when the Summer Games were in Los Angeles in 1984, he was in charge of food safety for the entire Olympic endeavor. But four decades earlier, he was a Navy corpsman sent to Munford Point, North Carolina, to train alongside Marines, with whom he would eventually deploy to the Pacific.
When I first got to Munford Point, I didn't know what it was. It was a camp outside of Jacksonville, by the New River. All black Marines were there.
The first blacks ever allowed into the Marine Corps.
Yes. They were amongst the first. The first ones were in 42, but I was there in 1944. Okay. That's when I was there. Yeah. And we went to a place called Hadnut Point where the hospital was. And then we were told, when you go to Munford Point, we want you to survey the whole place. There was a doctor there, I think his name was Asher, Dr. Asher. He said, it's a swamp, it's mosquitoes there, the water's bad, housing is bad, the food is bad, we want you guys to go over there and bring me back a report. And when I got over there, the guys were sleeping in wooden huts, dirt floors, rattlesnakes would come in there. They had no windows. Mosquitoes would come in from the swamp. This was the pure swamps. Now, growing up in the swamps as a youngster, I knew what it was. And there were bears there. There were everything you'd want from a swamp was there. Skunks, all snakes, mosquitoes, all kinds of bugs that would come in. You'd think mosquitoes were bad, but they had little things smaller than them, like gnats. They would get all over you, ticks, and eat you up. when we got back to Dr. Asher, he says, well, we're going to clean up those swamps. We're going to clear it. We're going to get rid of the snakes. What they did, they built a latrine upstream from a well. Like, up here's a latrine, down here's the well. Everything from that would go down into that well. So the guys, most of those men, had diarrhea all the time from that. And what happened was we had them reverse that. Then they brought in Quonset huts later on with wooden floors, metal things, and screens. And we would inspect those once a week to make sure they were clean. There were no snakes, no spiders, nothing in there, that the men were clean themselves. We did short arms inspections at that time. Those men were sick, most of them. A lot of those men had lice. A lot of them had VD from the South because they didn't get any medical care. And the white corpsmen didn't give a damn about them. Just let them die. They didn't want them in the Marine Corps anyway. So what we did with Dr. Asher, and that's when I met Bobby Troop, Route 66 piano player. He was captain then. And Bobby Troop set up a band, fights. I went and tried to box and got knocked out, and I quit. But the thing was I enjoyed the music and things like that there. Bobby Troop, what he did, he told us, says, you guys don't have to go to town to go to a theater. We're going to put a theater here on the base for you. You don't have to go through all that Jim Crow and racism. Because what had happened was a Marine from New York had gotten off the bus and went into the station there and asked, they had brought in vending machines for cigarettes. And he walked into the white side, not paying attention. They had signs up, colored white then. He went in the white side and threw a dollar bill at the lady and asked, say, sweetheart, can we change for a dollar? And she threw four quarters at him, and then she looked at him and then screamed. And then the police came and arrested him and took the guy and put him in jail. Now, word got back to Mumford Point that there was a Marine in jail down there. So it got over to Bobby Troop, Sergeant Fisher, who was white, another sergeant, very liberal people. They didn't go for that discrimination because they weren't from the South. And they said, we're going to go get that Marine. 1,000 black Marines got in trucks with 50 caliber machine guns on it. And we went into town, in that little old town. The railroad track went right down the middle. This side, and that black people this side, white people this side. City Hall was on this side. And the police station was on that side. And we went down there. And when we got down there, they were beating this Marine up. We arrested the whole police force. Wow. It was about eight policemen in there, the chief of police and everybody else, and took them back to Mumford Point and put them in the brig. Then all hell broke out from that. The commandant of the Marine Corps, he came over. What are you men going into town arresting police officers for? So we told him what he did. He said, we're not going to leave a Marine behind. What are you talking about? You're the commandant of the whole Marine Corps. Would you leave him behind? We had Tom McFadder at the time, Sergeant Thomas McFadder. He was the one that said, can't leave him there. Tom wrote a book called Caught in the Middle. And he became a Navy chaplain later on. But anyway, we took the Marine back, locked those officers up. The colonel just left us alone. They said, you guys go ahead and do what you're going to do. Just left us alone. And we kept those policemen in there for 5 days in the brig on bread and water and turned them loose. And we told them, don't you ever mess with a Marine again. That's what McFadder told them. Don't mess with any of these Mumford Point Marines. Because people were spitting on them and just harassing them and treating them mean. Boy, where'd you get that uniform? You don't belong in it, and spit on them. They cut all that stuff, was cut out. But That was, to me, it was outrageous behavior. And I had never seen this. Here, I'm going to go fight Germans and Japanese. And here, they're treating us worse than them because they had some German prisoners of war there. They treated them better than us. So that kind of got us. Later on at Mumford Point, another thing happened that's not written about, and that was the Royal Dutch Marines came to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, 5,000 of them. And these Marines had come from, I think they were over in North Africa someplace. When Hitler invaded their land, they went over there. Then they went to the Caribbean, and then they went through training. And they were there at Camp Lejeune to learn amphibious training, because they're going to reinvade where Hitler was and right. where the Japanese was in the Pacific. And what they said was the commandant, the Marine Corps, came and told the commandant of those Royal Dutch Marines, because they had 500 black Royal Dutch Marines. And he did not want those black Marines in Camp Lejeune. Told that commander, send those Marines over to Mumford Point. We segregate them here. That did not fly. That commander says, you don't leave a Marine behind. We're not going to leave any of ours. Those are our Marines. Where they go, we go. Now, if they're going to Mumford Point, we went. So 5,000 Royal Dutch Marines went over to Mumford Point, and we had a ball with those guys. I mean, especially, you know, after it going down to the beer hall and all of that with the music and things. We had a ball with those guys. They stayed there for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they left. But that was an experience to see. And what it did to me, I said, my God, I'd write letters home to my mother and tell her about it. And she'd say, Robert, I'm going to tell you something. If people are going to be prejudiced against you, make them pay for it. Don't you ever forget them. Make them spend some money. That's the only thing they know is money. So that stuck with me throughout my lifetime. Make them pay. If they're going to discriminate against you, make them pay. But anyway, a lot was going on there with the Medical Corps. The Marines got better. They got better treatment. They bowed out now to a corpsman. We were the first ones in line at the chow hall. They waited on us. When we went out on liberty, they gathered around us and just took care of us. We didn't have to spend one penny for nothing if we went out with those Mumford Pointers. So when we got overseas, they still rallied around the corpsman. And the corpsman had to look, there's about four platoons. Platoon had 40 men. And that's 160 men. We had to watch them, keep an eye on them. Something happened to them, you were there with them. And they knew that. The military part of what we did at Mumford Point was outstanding. The guys were expert marksmen with artillery. They were expert. Anti-aircraft guns. They had the 51st, 52nd anti-aircraft battalions. And one day they were shooting target practice. And they said, you guys are missing the target. And they said, no, we're not aiming at the target. We're aiming at the string. And then one shell went right and clipped the target. So that happened. In marching, if you ever watch the Marines march, you'll see a swagger that they got from the Mumford Point Marines, from Big Elmo. They put these men in ammo companies and supply companies, non-in-combat battalions. We all had weapons. If we had to use them, we used them. But we had all the food, all the medical supplies. We had all the ammunition. We had everything the Marines would want. And we brought those to those islands.
And you ended up on Guam, is that right?
I ended up there at Camp Wise at the medical dispensary on Guam. We had a small hospital there. Then over, we called it Barracuda Village, near the airfield up there in the Gana. where the Marines were. That was the 51st and 52nd anti-aircraft companies up there. Later on, we had two black doctors. One was a Lieutenant J.G., another one was a full lieutenant. Alvin Lawrence was lieutenant. He was from Chicago. C.J. Jones from New York, from Brooklyn, he was Lieutenant J.G. They had some stories. I wish they were alive because they told me what they were up against as officers. A lot of the white sailors and Marines wouldn't salute them. And Dr. Jones went and put his hat on a post and told this Marine, if you can't salute me, you salute that hat. But he went through a lot. But if somebody, and he was a surgeon, and he treated a lot of those guys. And one of the things that they did, they carried segregation too far. They segregated blood. 1X for white, 2X for black, 3X for Mexican, 4X for Native American on the bottles. Wow. When blood is only A, A, B, and O, you know. And one time in surgery, I went and got, they were operating on this white guy. They needed blood, and they told me to go down and bring back some A blood. I brought back a bottle of A blood. I didn't know nothing about these X's, and it had two X's on it. And I handed it to the nurse. She dropped it on the floor, broke it. And the doctor there operated, what did you drop that for? And she said, we can't give him, use the N-word, blood. Wow. And that doctor said, listen, blood is blood. I wanted A blood. Give it to him. I don't care what the X's are. It doesn't mean a damn thing.
Right.
So in the meantime, you had a hematologist named Dr. Charles Drew, who invented blood plasma. The United States wouldn't use its plasma, so he took it to England. And when Hitler was bombing England, 1945, tearing it up, there was a shortage of blood. The Americans wanted to know, you have a shortage of blood over here? He said, no, we use Dr. Drew's blood plasma. And they said, oh, we can't use that. It's crystal. We can't segregate it. And they laughed at the American doctors for that. See? And then they started using it. And right then and there, they start using this plasma. And they took them X's off those bottles. And then Roosevelt died after that. When Roosevelt died and Harry Truman got in there, all sorts of things were happening in the armed forces, black troops, the army. You had Camp Van Dorn. You had Fort Bliss, riots. You had Port Chicago, and there was one up, Shoemaker, there was one up there, Tuskegee Airmen. There's one in Louisiana. All these broke out, and it started affecting the war effort. And Harry Truman says, we're not going to have none of that. We're going to integrate the whole thing. And I don't care if those Southern colonels and generals object to it. They could get the hell out. That's what they could do. So the whole thing got integrated in 48. So all of these things turned to, you know, being a citizen of being born in this country. And I say, now, sometimes I say, now, who do I really belong to? You know, I'm not going to say I belong to this group. I belong to that group. I belong to all of them. So that makes me 100% American with no hyphens.
World War II Navy veteran Robert Hammond, a corpsman with the famed Mumford Point Marines. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a World War II veteran who experienced severe discrimination. In fact, he said it almost cost him his life, all born out of a case of mistaken racial identity. The thousands of people upon whom he would eventually perform heart surgery are awfully glad he survived. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. Bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. Selma, you can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special episode marking the start of Black History Month. Dr. Fitzalbert Marius lived an incredible life, eventually spending decades as a heart surgeon, among many other talents. It was the chance at a career in medicine that caused him to join the Army Specialized Training Program during World War II.
That was in December 1942. I joined, enlisted in the Army under that thing. At the end of my second year, they took me out of there and came down at Oxford, Pennsylvania, and picked us, all of us who had joined that program, and took us up to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where we would be interviewed. So I wound up at Fort Dix, and now this is very, very interesting, and if it hadn't happened to me, because as you know, back in that time, the Army was absolutely segregated. No blacks could be in a white part of the Army. And on top of that, very few black officers. The officers over most of the black units were white officers who did not meet the qualifications to be over the white units. And they became the lieutenant and the captain over your units, like they were over mine. And they had certain kinds of things, myths and so on, during that period of time. Like, during that period of time, you only had four races. It's not like today, you know, with the multiplicity of stuff that they have. The four races, white, colored, yellow, and red. And you had to fall in one of those four categories. And there were no other categories you fell into. So, and blacks, of course, fell under colored. So I wound up there, I remember, going in for my interview. And they also had, there was a myth among the whites at that time that you did not look a black male directly in the eye all for any long periods of time, because if you do, it was just like walking on the ladder or black cat crossing or being on the 13th floor.
Oh boy.
So they didn't look at you. Uh-huh. So when I went in, this white lieutenant was sitting on the other side, and I went in and stood up at attention, you know, and he said, not looking up at all, he's looking down at the paper, and it didn't look up at me the whole interview, and says, relax, soldier, sit down. So I sat down. and I'm looking, but he never looked at me. And he began asking the usual questions, says, name, Fitzalbert Michael Marius. Now, that ain't a name like Jim Brown. And on top of that, I had a New York accent with some inflections of the West Indian accent in it, sure, at that time. So I didn't say y'all, yes, boss, you know, none of that stuff. So I didn't have nothing Southern, nothing sounded like a colored man. And a name, Fitzalbert M. Marius? All right. Place of birth, Colon, Panama, not Biloxi, Mississippi. He went on down the line as education. 2 years of college. Now, most blacks at that time was lucky to make it to the fifth grade. And he just went on and on and on and on. And then he got way down to the, what you call it, do you speak any other language besides English? And I said, yes, sir, I speak French. Because I grew up speaking French. Now, none of these characteristics match anything colored. These characteristics are written down there are the characteristics you find associated with an intelligent white man. So after a while, he looked at the paper, and then he looked up for the first time, and you could see this, his eyes open wide, because what he saw did not match what was on the paper. So he said to me, he says, soldier, private, are you colored? And at that time, I was not very, you know, I didn't have the insight that I have now. If I'd have simply said yes, I'd have gotten into the program. But instead of that, I said, what do you think? And he looked at me and looked at the paper several times. And then he took out something and he wrote something on the paper and it says, soldier, you're discharged. You may leave. And I left. And the next morning, I was the only person of the group that received an order to get on a train to head for Denver, Colorado, at Fitzsimmons General Hospital. So naturally, I'm a soldier, I obeyed it. And I got all the way to Denver, Colorado, got to Fitzsimmons General Hospital, and it was a base about 1,600 to about 2,000 men. And I was the only individual on that base this color. Everybody else on that base was white. It was a 2.5 to 3 month program where they trained you to work with doctors on the field, you know, as a doctor's assistant, a nurse, you know, and so on down the line. So they put me in a barrack, and I was on the upper bunk, the top of the bed, and at the bottom bed was a young white guy from Georgia, and his father was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Now you got to be kidding me. I mean, all of this is hard to believe, but that one, I mean, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, well, the odds of this is, and like I said, if I hadn't experienced it myself, it would be hard to believe, with the Army segregated. So the whole time that I was there, the 2.5 to almost 3 months, I slept with the one eye open because they verbally abused me every opportunity you get. I can't tell you the things they called me. And whenever they got an opportunity, they physically kicked my butt. But just about a week or so before the time was concluded, six of them caught me off to the side by myself, beat my butt up really bad, and then grabbed me by the feet and had me hanging upside down, dipping my head into a barrel of oil where they were going to drown me. And fortunately, a captain came by. And naturally, you know, captain has to follow his orders and not allow any soldier to harm another soldier regardless, you know. So brought no charges against them at all. But anyway, after I left there, I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, which is outside of Dallas. And it was the first time, you know, I didn't know, you know, how did I wind up here in this situation? And naturally, the captain was a white captain, and he was also from Georgia, you know, and he was, then I'm standing at attention, and he's looking at the record, and he just fell out laughing. And naturally, I never changed the expression on my face because you learn as a soldier, you know, how to act, you know. And I just stood there watching. And then finally, after he laughed a while, he reached and got a big, long stamp, which was about 8 inches, And then he stamped right across the middle of the document, colored. And I said, oh, my God. This stupid lieutenant had put down there that I was white. And that's how I wound up in Denver, Colorado. Because what he probably said to himself was this. Now, this guy was born in Colon, Panama. Now, he's of dark skin, but he speaks a different language. And no color, none of these characteristics meets colored. If I'm going to make a mistake, I would much rather make the mistake the other way around than putting a white man with blacks. So when the Army was completely segregated, Fitzalbert M. Marius, for almost 3 months, was white. But it almost got me killed. It was the worst 3 months that I've ever spent in my whole life.
And I've got to ask you, I mean, there's, you tell the story so well in such captivating fashion, and I don't think you left anything out, but I'm just imagining you, as you described, six guys have grabbed you, so obviously fighting back is futile. They've got you outnumbered. They've overpowered you.
Yeah.
And they're hanging you by your ankles, dipping your face into a barrel of oil. So what's going through your mind as that is happening?
I'm getting killed. That's what's going through my mind.
Yeah.
That's all that's happening. I'm not thinking of nothing else. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking I ain't going to make it.
How close do you think you came to being killed right there? I mean, how much longer would it have taken if that guy, the captain, didn't come by?
I don't know. You know, I have no idea of knowing. All I can remember is they were killing my butt. And fortunately, the captain came by and my life was saved. Now, little details about how many minutes it was, none of that made any effect on me. Mm-hmm. The major aspect was my life was saved. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can remember. Yeah.
And every veteran I've talked to, it seems like, has at least one moment where his life was spared. Most of those, though, are in the war, not here in the States before you ever got to war because of this extreme case of mistaken identity. That I guess really underscores, not to get up on a soapbox and not to be master of the obvious, but doesn't that underscore the fallacy and erroneous idea that these racist thoughts originate from? I mean, doesn't it expose how stupid racism is?
Of course it does. Of course it does. But it does not change the sociological and social system. Your social system changes from the heart. Not from the intellect. You see, you can make all the laws you want. Mm-hmm. It will not change the way a person feels. They'll work around the laws. I mean, I found I did the same kind of stuff myself, working around the law. Now, before I gave myself over to Christ in 1967, I lived a life what I would have called integrity, because I was always an honest man. I didn't lie. I told the truth. If I made a commitment, I kept it. Now, the commitment may not have been the right thing to do, but I kept it anyway because I was a man of my oath. Uh-huh. My mother told me, Bertie, don't you ever make an oath you don't keep. You hear that, boy? Mm-hmm. And I can still hear her now telling me that. So I kept those kind of oaths. I didn't go out. You know, I was raised Catholic, so marriage meant one woman, one time and stuff. So it was, I wasn't out running after a whole bunch of other women or none of that kind of stuff. But I was just following orders. It was no change of heart involved. And that only occurred after I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior in 1967 in March the 3rd. And I remember that date very specifically because it was 2 days after my birthday, March the 1st. Mm-hmm. But that's where the difference came, remembering and having a change of heart. You see, not an intellectual attitude, but a change of heart. So anyway, when I wound up in the South Pacific and all those areas you read about, Guadalcanal and Bougainville and all those places, I was there.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about how you ended up there. So they, you know, so we don't lose a segment of the story here. You're in Denver, you almost are killed, they figure out this paper's wrong, he's clearly not Caucasian, they put that big colored stamp on your file.
That's when I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, and went to basic training.
With other African American troops?
Of course. I was black again. I was among the white folks no longer.
Uh-huh. How was that different, being with an all-black unit and going through basic training with all black soldiers all of a sudden after the time you'd spent surrounded by nothing but white soldiers?
Well, the number one thing, I was not concerned. I could sleep with both eyes closed. And nobody was going to cuss me out because I was black. They had other reasons, too, which they did later on, but not because I was black.
You're an all-black unit that is in the Pacific, and you're following along with the 1st Marine Division. You're attached to the 1st Marine Division. But what was your job? What were you guys supposed to come in and do?
All we're supposed to do was to take care of all of these things like disease, insects, and stuff like that. If there were some certain flies and stuff, we were to get rid of them. We had the stuff to spray, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Dig the ditches, to drain the swamps, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we did. And then of course, when things happened, to bury the dead. Now, what happened, as a matter of fact, it was in Iwo Jima. When we were going in the invasion of Iwo Jima, they had the two units. So one had to go in because there were certain insects and flies and stuff and that carried a certain amount of certain diseases and stuff that they had to go in to take care of. So they flipped a coin to decide which unit would go in. No, it was a straw, the short straw and the long straw. All right. So we picked the right straw. So they had to go in first with the 1st Marine Division. And there in Iwo Jima, they had caves up there, and the Japanese had the guns and all that stuff on tracks. They pulled them back into the cave. So even though they bombed all the areas and stuff like that before they sent the troops in, they had all the major troops and stuff all back there because there was an airport there that the United States wanted to control and take over. But anyway, when they first sent the 1st Marines in, they also sent the 727th because the 727th lost and they went in. Now, there's 125 people belonging to each one of those groups. Only three of them made it back. All the rest of them got killed. Now, if we had gone in first, we would have only had three left. Yeah. So the Lord was looking out after me and that group. So, and a lot of things happened like that. And at Guadalcanal, almost got wiped out at Guadalcanal because there, the Japanese at that time, you know, had their planes, and we didn't have the fast planes to keep up with them at that time, and they hadn't just put them out yet. And so they would come in, and they would bomb the heck out of the areas, and we were in foxholes, and they bombed us for 2 weeks and stuff like that. All kinds of people got killed and so on. But I made it through, and as a matter of fact, the Lord blessed the heck out of me because the whole 3 years or so that I was over in that South Pacific, I did not get one disease. As many anopheles mosquitoes as I got bitten with, I never got malaria. I never got any of those other diseases. All those other people got shot all around me, and I never got one injury. The Lord was looking out for Bert Marius because I wasn't looking out for myself.
Dr. Fitz Albert Marius. And, of course, you can link to his complete original interview along with hundreds of others at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time, but as we move along through Black History Month, what if we all take the initiative to seek out some of that history that maybe we have not been made familiar with before? Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.